You're listening to the Exploring Research Careers podcast, the podcast that talks to people about their research careers and also explores personal histories of those who support researchers. In this episode, I speak with Connor Reid, Development Manager at the Podcast Studios. We talk about Connor's research career, starting with his PhD in English literature, moving into different positions as an English language teacher, culminating as Director of Studies. We end up at the point where he is currently Development Manager of the Podcast Studios in Dublin. We talk through the different skills he's developed over the years, how he developed them, and advice that he gives to people thinking about taking on a PhD today. Connor, you're so welcome and thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks very much, yeah.
Would you talk us through the process, you know, applying for PhD, if there was a thought process, how it happened that you decided to do a PhD, those kind of things that were going on in your mind at the time?
Yeah, I guess it was one of those things where I assume it's similar, but a lot of people were kind of one thing led to another. So I finished up my degree. I did English and Italian in UCD. And I just, you know, I really wanted to do more. And I kind of immediately started looking around for different masters and things that I could do. And I found one in Trinity, which was an MPhil in popular literature. And I just kind of thought, wow, this looks really interesting and really different. And there wasn't really anything else like it at the time. I started looking into that. And I was like, yeah, definitely, this is what I want to do. So I did the master's there and absolutely loved it. And I'm not sure. I guess when I started the master's, I thought maybe this is something I want to do. Maybe I'll head down the sort of PhD route. I'd always kind of really liked teaching and have ended up doing lots of different teaching in my career since. But I guess I had kind of thought that was one option anyway. But really, the more I researched and did different parts of the master's, the more I was kind of like, I don't want this to end. I really like this. And I liked all the different elements of it. And I kind of said, yeah, no, I definitely want to start thinking about putting something together. So in this kind of second half of the year in the master's, it was just like one of the essay topics that I did. The more I did it, the more I was like, wow, there's loads and loads and loads in this. This is something that I could really kind of delve into. That's when I kind of started thinking about it. I also kind of realized that I just wouldn't have enough time to properly put together a proposal and think about what I wanted to do whilst also finishing the master's and writing the thesis over the summer and all that kind of stuff. So I figured, look, I'll take a year out and just go and work and get a bit of money together and think about how it might be feasible to fund a PhD and put together a proposal and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of what I did. I just sort of fell into it.
So you actually did decide to do a PhD in the sense, you know, because some people kind of, you know, sometimes when I talk with people, they say, well, my supervisor got funding and they offered me the PhD and I didn't have anything else lined up. So I thought, yeah, maybe I'd do it. You actually thought, this could be for me. I'm going to take some time out and actually plan this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It obviously varies a lot from subject to subject. I don't get the impression in English anyway, there are massive numbers of, hey, I've got loads of funding, come do a PhD with me type situations that you might get, particularly in the sciences and stuff where you kind of need, you know, a team. And so you know, there are things like that obviously in English, but there's not huge numbers of them. So there was never a point where someone was like, I have funding, will you come and work with me on this project? I was just like, I'd like to do this. How can I get together some funding to do that? And really, that was just by working.
So your PhD was self-funded?
Yeah.
Which is the case, as you say, often in the arts and humanities, that people self-fund their PhD rather than, as you say, in STEM, where they might be able to obtain funding from somewhere.
There was bits and pieces. So, you know, I applied for an Irish Research Council bursary, but I think I was a little bit naive going into that, the amount of work that's actually required to really put together a proposal like that. It's hugely time consuming. And I think I sort of went into it and I didn't really give it the time and attention that it kind of really deserved. And so at that stage, I had already started working in English language teaching. And it actually worked really, really well because it was a job that I could do for like 3 hours in the morning and then start working on the PhD straight afterwards. And it paid like relatively well for the kind of a job that you could do in quite a limited number of hours. So I kind of had a nice little setup going on. And I kind of, at that stage, I was like, look, this is working well. I did get a bursary from the School of English in my final year, which kind of got me some money and a waiver of fees and other things like that. And there were a few other little bits and pieces for various things. But it was by and large funded through English language teaching, which I was doing part-time.
And had you already started that that teaching, or was that something that you started that after your master's?
Yeah. I kind of, again, just sort of fell into it. I was doing some grinds. I was just like, look, I'll make a bit of cash. I was doing like Leaving Cert English grinds. And I think I was just putting up some signs around the place being like, hey, I teach grinds. And as an afterthought, I was like, and I can also teach English language, even though I'd never done it in my life. And I just got one student and they were just like really nice. And we had a really good relationship. And then like she told like two or three of her friends and I started teaching them. They told their friends. And then suddenly I had like 8 or 9 students. And I was like, oh, wow, I should probably start, you know, doing this a little bit more systematically and properly looking into how to, you know, be an English language teacher. And that was great, but it was very kind of casual and, you know, people would, you know, send you a text an hour beforehand being like, oh, sorry, I can't make it this week. And so it wasn't kind of very reliable. So I was like, look, I really like this. Why don't I go and do the like TEFL certificate that you need? It's like a month long course, and just go get a job in a school where it's a little bit more reliable. And, you know, so I did the course and realized that, you know, all the stuff I'd been teaching was, you know, I was teaching the
completely
right
wrong
things. Well, I was teaching the right things in really the wrong way. You know, I did really sort of all over the place. So I was like, okay, well, look, I can do this, but this, you know, there are a lot of things I need to learn about how to do this. So I started teaching English, and I got a job. I finished the course on like a Friday, and I had somehow managed to land a job the following Monday or Tuesday. So I got a job in a great school, which I really, really enjoyed, and kept that going then throughout the whole PhD. And it just worked really well because I could go in, I could teach in the morning. I would teach, say, from like 9:30 until 12:30 or something, 1:00. And then I'd just go across the road into Trinity and work away in the PhD until 6 or 7 or something like that. So I was kind of doing a part-time job on a full-time PhD or something like that. But they worked well together.
At that point then, you're in your PhD and you're working away. Were you thinking, when this is over, I'd love to try the academic route?
Yeah, I had kind of always said when I started it that I would definitely like to try to be a lecturer. But I was very aware from talking to people and everything else that it's not an easy job to get, that there are just so few jobs, particularly in Ireland. I guess early on I had thought, look, you know, there still is a very good chance of getting an academic job if you're quite willing to travel very widely, you know, if you're not too fussy about where you live.
I think even then it's tough enough.
No, of course. Yeah. But you know, yeah. If you're limiting your options, you know, the more you limit your options, obviously the less that's out there. And I guess early on I had kind of thought like, yeah, look, maybe move to the UK or whatever else. But as the PhD went on and I got married and my wife had a career which wasn't going to be very movable, and I like living in Dublin anyway, I was just kind of like, look, it's unlikely I'm going to go and move to Sheffield or Alabama or Vancouver or something to get a job. So the more I realized that, I was like, look, I'll see how this goes, but I think I would prefer to stay in Dublin and do something else than get an academic job and it is wherever kind of thing. So that was kind of my thinking. I was never like lecturing or bust. I always figured there were other things out there.
And so when you finished your PhD, what did happen?
So I finished up the PhD, and just as I was finishing up, the owner of the school that I've been working in for the last couple of years, I guess it was a 4-year PhD, and I'd started working there about a year before. So at that stage, I'd been teaching the school for 5 years. And the school had expanded a lot and was getting much, much bigger. So he offered me the position of the director of studies, which is kind of like the manager, kind of academic manager. So you're managing all the teachers and the syllabus and curriculum and all that kind of stuff. So I was like, yeah, after all of this time working part-time and a non-funded PhD and being penniless, this was like a job with a good salary. And like, it just very much appealed to me. So I was like, yes, look, I'll keep the academic thing on the side there for a minute. Yes. So I mean, even as I was finishing up the PhD, I was kind of moving into that role. So by the time I did my Viva, I'd already been working full time for a couple of months in that job. And that was great because I really enjoyed the job and it was a really nice place to work. And over the years, I knew all the teachers, and then any new teachers that came on, I had hired them, and it just kind of became, it was a great job. I really, really liked it. But I always kind of thought, like, look, I'm not going to stay in this forever. I don't really think I want to be a language academic manager type person. So I kind of said, look, I'll see how this goes. And I did it for 2.5 years or something like that. And while I was doing that, I published a couple of articles and I did a few bits and pieces like that with a view to being like, look, I'll see if this can kind of work to sort of do this job, apply for other stuff. And if some sort of position comes up, jump. But like most of these things, it's really hard to work full time in a job. And, the hours were long enough in that job and also be trying to publish and applying for jobs and all this kind of stuff. So at a certain point, I was just kind of like, look, I think I need to leave this job cold and just, put everything forward and say, look, I also wanted to make the PhD into a book. And I've been chipping away at it for a while, but I got a publisher then, and I was like, look, I can get this book finished and published. I have a couple of articles which are in the works and everything else. I was like, now is the time to just apply for a lot of jobs and just kind of see what happens. And so I did that. I left the job. And then my son was also about to be born as well. So that was, I was like, clean break.
Sounds like a brave move with a baby on the way.
Yeah, it was a bit kind of crazy. In a way, it was like, look, if I stay here and have a kid, I'll never go, because I'll be like, oh, I need the financial security. Whereas if I just be nice and reckless and go, like, look, I'll just leave the job and like, I'll pick up something else. Because the other thing is, like, there was always language teaching work available. I could just go back and be a language teacher. And like, the money's not amazing, but it's not bad either. So I was like, look, that's there as a fallback. I'll apply for a load of academic jobs, see what happens. And if it doesn't, I'll take it from there. And then, have a baby along the way as well.
And were there many opportunities to apply for jobs at that stage?
Not many, to be honest. There were some things. I was looking all over Ireland and I did apply for some UK positions as well, but it was a bit like, ugh, if something really good comes along, we can kind of have a think, as a family at that point, whether to kind of move or not or whatever. But I was kind of more hoping something might come up in Dublin or, Cork or Galway or whatever. There wasn't a huge amount, but I figured, like, look, I'll see what's out there. I'll apply for everything I can. And I just wanted to kind of think, look, I tried the lecturing thing. I put my best foot forward. I had some publications. I did my PhD and I applied to see what was out there. And if I got a job, great. If I didn't, then I could kind of close that door and say, look, yep, I did that. I absolutely loved doing the PhD. It was one of the best experiences of my life. I tried for some academic jobs. But the one thing I didn't want to do, which was what, so many people do, is just the whole academic, like, thing where you finish your PhD and you get 1 hour of teaching in UCD and 2 hours in Maynooth and 1 hour in Trinity, and you have no contract, you have no rights, you're badly paid, and you do that for like 10 years with this dangling carrot of a possible job down the line, and it's so exploitative. And I was just like, I'm not playing that game. So I was like, look, I'll apply, I'll see what happens, but if not, I'm out, and I'm happy to be out. I just didn't want to end up in that world of
Never-ending contracts or never-ending non-contracts.
Contract if you're lucky, yeah. I mean, nearly all the work doesn't even have a contract, because if they gave you a contract, they'd have to formalize it, and the universities don't have the funding to formalize anything. So it's just horrible, sort of really demoralizing structure and setup. So I kind of just didn't want to get involved in that, to be honest.
It sounds though you'd thought it through. You know, if it happens, it happens, great. And if it doesn't, I'm not going to chase this forever.
Yeah, I hadn't realized. I kind of knew it was bad, but I didn't realize it was that bad.
Okay. You did go back to Trinity to finish. You published your book. Did you do a contract at that point?
When I left the director of studies job, I left the job. I applied for a postdoc as well at that time as well. So I basically finished up the job and said, look, I'll do everything. So I published the book. I published some articles. I started researching a new area, and I applied for a postdoc, which I didn't get, although I was pretty close. So not so close that it was really annoying, you know, as in you're 1 point off or something, but close enough that it was respectable. So I was kind of happy with that. But I applied for the postdoc, and then I also just did a bit of teaching in Trinity while I was doing that, because I was like, look, not really for the money, because it was only a few hours, but just to be like, if you're applying for academic jobs, it's good to have on your CV that you are a lecturer or whatever. So I did. And in fairness, I got onto a couple of my former supervisor and some of the other lecturers and stuff, and they were able to help me out with even just giving me like a lecture here and there, just to kind of fill out some of the kind of gaps in my CV, you know, that I hadn't done postdoctoral teaching at that point. So I taught a couple of master seminars and, you know, stuff like that. So that kind of worked out well. So I just kind of figured that doing all of that was sort of like putting the best foot forward, or just giving it a try and kind of.
Because that seems to be the last piece then of academia. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So what happened then at the end of that situation?
So what happened was I started a podcast, and that was kind of the weird, completely unexpected link that kind of changed things for me.
Okay.
So I guess at around that time, podcasts were getting really, really big, and I was listening to more and more of them. And it was never something that I had kind of been, I was never like in the college radio, or I'd never really been hugely into sort of audio in terms of radio and kind of stuff like that. But the more I listened to podcasts, especially the really, really well produced, really well made American ones and stuff, I was just kind of like, wow, this stuff is amazing. And a lot of it is academic research, sort of, you know, made accessible and interesting and everything. And I just kind of thought, I was like, well, I research all of this really unusual and interesting kind of stuff. Like, my field is kind of in popular literature and popular culture and things like that. So I was kind of like, I have loads of stories and I have loads of research done, and it's all about things that people tend to be quite interested in, because they're all kind of aspects of the popular culture we see around us kind of all the time. So I was like, I have all this stuff, and, you know, I've done loads of teaching at this point, and I can, you know, I can obviously explain things and, you know, talk clearly and coherently and stuff like that. So I was like, I kind of have that side of stuff. So I was like, the only thing I'm kind of missing to sort of make a podcast is, you know, actually, how do you make a podcast? Like, what equipment do I need, and how do I, you know, record it and all that kind of stuff? But of all the different things you need, the actual technical stuff for making a podcast is very learnable online with YouTube videos and various things like that. So I basically just started thinking more and more about this, and I was like, yeah, look, why don't I sort of do this? So I kind of started getting that together, and towards the end of 2016, and I kind of launched that then in 2017. And I just realized that I really, really liked it. So kind of everything, it was kind of, I guess I'd kind of always in a way wanted to sort of start, not necessarily start my own business, but kind of start something that was sort of mine. And that was kind of, it's kind of like starting your own little tiny business. You know, you make a website, you start promoting your product, i.e. the podcast. You're promoting it on social media and so on. You're watching the numbers go up. You're thinking about how to make it better and improve it and advertise it and so on. And I kind of realized that I really liked all the elements. I liked the interviewing. I liked the technical aspect. I really like editing and crafting it together. And it felt very creative in a way that, you know, academia is a type of creativity, but it's a different type of creativity, you know. So I really, really liked it, and I started doing it more and more. And at that point, I was kind of like, there isn't really a job in this. There isn't really a job in podcasting as such in Ireland that I was really aware of. There was kind of radio stuff. So
what were you actually working at still at this point?
So at that point, I had said, look, I would really like to do more of this podcasting thing, but obviously it's not paying any money at this point. It's a hobby. So I was like, look, maybe there's something in this. Maybe I can sort of grow this a little bit, or I'd like to at least explore how I can grow this or do something with this. So some friends of mine who I had worked with in the language school that I was in had started their own school, and they had kind of said, listen, if you ever want to be a teacher, you know, come teach in our school. So I kind of started looking into this more and more, and I was like, yeah, look, will I just go teach and start building this podcast idea and kind of see what happens? So I started English language teaching again, which was actually really nice, because when I'd been doing the English language managing, you know, like all of these things, you do one thing and then you become a manager of that thing and you miss the original thing, you know. So I really love English language teaching, and I love the interaction and meeting the students and everything like that, and it's something I kind of miss now. But so I went back and I started doing more or less full-time English language teaching, but giving myself a little bit of time to make the podcast and do other stuff. And then I just kind of started adding more podcasty things to my life. So I started reviewing and writing about podcasts for a couple of different publications online. I started teaching podcasting in Rathmines College and Community College and as an evening course, and kind of pitched a course to them and kind of developed that. And then I joined the Head Stuff Podcast Network with my show. And then I started doing some writing for them. And then I started editing a new podcast section. And I was just like, my life was becoming more and more podcasty. So I was still teaching, but I was kind of like, right, so I now make a podcast, teach podcasting, write about podcasts, edit, you know, so doing it more and more. And then I was like, look, I'll start seeing if I can.
Were you getting paid for any of this podcasting stuff?
For the writing, but not huge okay. money, you know.
And not for anything else, still getting the teaching payment.
No, yeah. So the teaching was, you know, my bread and butter. So I was getting paid for some articles online. I was getting paid a little bit for editing. I was getting paid from, you know, I set up a Patreon for my podcast, getting a little bit of money from that. But, you know, all of that stuff was more just, you know, by the by. The main income was teaching. And then I started thinking, look, maybe I can start making podcasts for companies and for other people. So I started pitching a couple of ideas, and I kind of talked to a couple of different people about potentially making shows. I started making one then for the language school that I was working in. So that was kind of paid properly as a sort of a freelance podcast project. And
did the sheen wear off? I mean, obviously it mustn't have, given that you work in podcasting now, but you know the way they say when you have your hobby and then you start getting paid for it, it kind of changes.
Yeah, it didn't actually. And I got to the point where I was like, it became really frustrating, because I was like, I can nearly make this a career or a job or something, but it's such a hustle. And, you know, the freelance editing and podcasting and radio work and stuff like that, you know, you're putting in a lot of work just to get the clients and so on. And I was kind of like, oh, I don't know if I want to go down this route as such, but, you know, if I want to do it, this is what I'm going to have to do. And I was kind of just at this sort of crossroads where I was like, I don't want to keep English language teaching. I want to move on to something new, and I would love to do this podcasting full time, but there just isn't really anything there. And then just when I was like, oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Head Stuff, who I had been doing some writing for and who was part of the network, expanded and they got new studios and they were kind of like, right, we want to push out our kind of podcasting work. And they were like, we're looking to hire someone. Do you want to do that? I was like, yes, I do.
Talk about so, meant to be.
I know. I mean, it was a few years of sort of angling and positioning and everything like that. And it also sort of made, like, I never would have got the job if I hadn't started the podcast. And I put so much work into the podcast, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of hours really into the podcast, that it sort of really felt like it had paid off, that it was sort of worth it.
I have another question that I know we're going into the podcast territory, but it's more a personal question. So you can tell me to get lost if you want. But there seems to be, I guess, a flexibility or a freedom around you making these decisions, given that you're a father now. And, you know, I've had a child, but I didn't, you know, I was going back into teaching, you know, that kind of flexibility.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it was partly, I think part of it was just the fact that I just had this, not guaranteed, but sort of all but guaranteed fallback plan, in that, you know, teaching in English language and teaching in Ireland was, and well, up until very recently, still is sort of a booming industry. There's loads of work. I was at that point an extremely experienced teacher. So I could kind of, if I needed it, I could always just go and, you know, teach English. And it's quite tiring if you do 6 or 7 teaching hours a day on top of the prep and the various other stuff. It's quite a labor, you know, intensive job in that way. But, you know, it pays relatively well. You're not going to make your millions off it, but you can make it a decent enough salary kind of working full time. So I always kind of thought, like, look, that's there if I need it. So if I pull back my hours a little bit and just try and cut living expenses and things like that, then I can just, it was just, that gave me the flexibility. I could say, look, I'll pull back the hours a little bit and try something else. And if that works, great. If it doesn't, I'll just go back to more full-time teaching and then try something else. And there was a limit to how far I was going to go with this, and I had probably nearly reached it. But yeah, I guess that's what gave me the flexibility to a certain extent.
So at that point, were you thinking, oh my God, I've got the dream job. I've got the podcasting job that I've been kind of putting so much effort into for so long, and now I'm going to get paid for it.
Yeah, I know. It was amazing. It was sort of like, if someone had said, like, hey, just like make up an ideal job, that was kind of it. I was like, this is great. Wow. You know, I was like, I get to, you know, improve my skills and learn lots of new things about making and producing podcasts. I get to meet lots of people who kind of interesting and unusual, and different people are in and out of the studios all the time, and work on a lot of different kind of, a lot of arts-based stuff and things like that. So it was, yeah, it's great. You know, unfortunately, a couple of months after we opened the studios, they all had to close again. but the flip side of that is business has never been better, because everybody's making podcasts because they can't have conferences and events and various things like that. So it's actually, we're ridiculously busy at the moment.
Can I talk to you a little bit about skills?
Mm.
I suppose, given what you've said, you know, even working in tech, there's probably a new software, a new platform comes out probably every week at this stage. Yeah. Like, when you think about how you learn now versus how you would have learned as a researcher, like, are we talking worlds apart, or would you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm thinking about people who might be listening and might think they started out in research, but maybe it's not for them. Maybe they're thinking something like this would be amazing for me. What do they need to be thinking about, or what would they need to be doing to be making them attractive to some company like that you're working for?
Yeah, I always felt, and you know, I've chatted to lots of researchers and former researchers about this, that I think in the arts and humanities in particular, PhD students tend to massively undersell themselves or undervalue the skills that they have. You know, if you do a PhD in, I don't know, like 19th century French history, like, your expertise, once you leave this one single job being a lecturer, your expertise isn't 19th century French history. You know, your expertise is all the other stuff. It's like incredibly good project management skills. It's communication and teaching skills. It's being able to distill large volumes of information into you know, digestible chunks and able to kind of get that across to other people. You know, it's all of those other skills. It's that kind of self-motivation that you need to sort of keep going with the PhD. And you often need to, you know, learn lots of new things to complete any PhD, different types of skills and things like that. But you pretty much always just have to learn how to do them on your own. But you never have like a colleague to walk you through how something works. You just go and learn it. So I think it's all of those skills that are really useful for in all sorts of ways for all sorts of employers, but which I think PhD students don't often realize they have, or maybe...
I agree. You know, I think they're surprised when they hear that people value those skills.
Yeah, yeah.
And employers in all sorts of sectors value those skills.
Yeah. And I think, to be honest, you have to sort of dress it up a bit or spell it out a little bit for employers. I think if you walk in, you know, you hear about people taking their PhD off their CV because it gives you a better chance of getting a job. And to me, that seems a little bit ridiculous. I think that's completely the wrong approach. I think leave the PhD on your CV, even if you're not applying for an academic job, but present it in a way that highlights the skills that you gain from doing a PhD that aren't like, well, I learned loads about, you know, popular literature at the turn of the century, because that's not going to be relevant for most other jobs. But the other skills are. So why not kind of push them? And I think a lot of it is the sort of self-motivation and ability to work things out on your own and work through things and stick at it and so on, which really useful for loads of jobs. It's the same sort of skills I use now, like you're saying, when there's new things to learn and new technologies and new stuff like that. You just get out there and have a look and see how they work and give it a go, kind of thing.
Can I ask about maybe on reflection, the best decision, career decision you've made? I mean, I think from listening to you, it's leaving that job and just diving in and hoping it would all work out.
Yeah, no, I think it probably was. Like, it's funny, I wouldn't kind of say, you know, was, when you say like the best decision I ever made was leaving that job, it was, you know, you hear about people who are like stuck in these jobs that they hate and they can never leave. Like, I loved working there. The problem was that I felt like I was just going to get too comfortable, and that it was such a nice job, it was such a lovely place to work. And it was kind of high pressure, but it was stressful enough and there was a lot of moving parts. But like, I kind of thought, I'm just going to get sucked in here and I'm just going to do this for forever. And I knew I didn't want to do it forever. But I feel like, yeah, it was a really good decision, but not in a negative way that you maybe sometimes hear with other jobs. So I guess, to be honest, I guess the best career decision I ever made was starting a podcast as a hobby, which, you know, wasn't really a career decision at all. It was just something I thought this could be fun to do.
I suppose that's one thing I've noticed, is that like at one point your day job wasn't developing those skills that you ended up really relying on, or that kind of brought you to where you really love at the moment. Like, they were all part of your other part of your life.
Yeah, I guess so. It was kind of, it was developing stuff that I was just doing as a hobby. Or, I mean, I was always kind of thinking, look, if I learn how to make a website for my podcast, knowing how to make a website is a good skill to have. And that was kind of part of the motivation as well. There was a lot of skills like that, which I just didn't really know much about, learning how to use different software and things like that, which, you know, come out of a English PhD and you're like, I could use Microsoft Word or whatever. So kind of learn some of those things. What I thought was just, I was like, there's no bad side of learning. Like, I did some stuff online, learning a little bit about how to code with sort of HTML and CSS and things like that. And they were all just kind of interest things. But I was, you know, in the back of my mind is like, look, none of these things are going to not stand to me or whatever.
Can I ask you, I know you have mentioned like now working in the podcast that you kind of do a bit of everything and that everyone probably does a bit of everything, but talk us through a typical day. Like, what did you do today, for example?
So a good chunk of my day is editing. So depending on the show, so some shows you'd have more involvement from the beginning and during the actual production of it. So, you know, you're producing it. So you'd be in on the recording, trying to help shape the show and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I did a recording today. So I was in on that. I was working with the host and the other kind of producer on their end, trying to get everything sorted. They did the interview. We had a chat about it afterwards, how we're going to use it and shape it and so on. I'll go away then and I'll edit that. I'll send them back a draft and be like, hey, here's what I've done so far. I'd maybe recommend changing here and here and here, but let me know what you think or whatever. They'll send me back their ideas. I'll edit it from there. And depending on the client, some ones are very quick turnaround, some are much, much bigger projects. So a lot of it is kind of editing and production and stuff like that. And then that was the other thing, which is really nice. I do all the teaching and training in Head Stuff as well. So I run an evening course on podcasting. I do lots of kind of one-to-one consultations and stuff, teaching people how to, well, these days record online and at home and things like that, but also previously in the studio, and workshops and various things like that. So I still get to do some teaching, which is really nice. I was kind of really happy not to leave teaching completely behind. So I would still do a little bit of teaching most weeks in one form or another, particularly with the evening course. So I do that. And then business development stuff, looking for new clients and thinking about new ideas, pitching stuff to people, lots of back and forth with my colleagues. So we just hired another person there this week. So there's now six of us. So it's kind of getting bigger. So there's more coordination and collaboration. And yeah, it's nice to work in a team of people as well, rather than, you know, PhD is very solitary. Nice to kind of work that way as well. So yeah, so that's kind of what I'm doing for most of the day. If the studios are open, then people are coming in, you're getting them set up, you're working on that kind of stuff. And
I'm sure it's a lot more dynamic in the studio because you do have that personal interaction with people. And
it's nice. It is great. Yeah. Kind of, yeah, just when it's just for those sweet couple of months when the studio was open and, you know, lots of people were coming in and out every day. And, you know, and it's nice as well because you just, you know, I get to meet loads of kind of artists and authors and TV personalities and, yeah, lots of different people. And
it sounds absolutely fascinating.
Obviously, it's not all wonderful. Like you will edit podcasts that, like, I edit lots of shows I have zero interest in, you know, that I'm sure are excellent shows, but it's just like, I'm not interested in corporate finance or whatever this show is about. So I just edit away, and it's, you know, like any job in the world, there are bits that interest you and there are bits that you just do because they're part of the job, and that's fine, you know.
Yeah. So I have one last kind of area I want to just touch on because it's been so interesting. I suppose I'm thinking, like, what kind of advice would you give to people who are thinking about doing a PhD in the arts? And what would you be saying to them based on your experience and the pathway that you've had?
Yeah, I guess as you kind of probably guessed and kind of touched on, I would definitely go into any PhD with eyes very wide open. You know, I think... Okay, first of all, if you're starting a PhD and the only thing in the world you want to do is be a lecturer, then either prepare to be crushingly disappointed or be prepared to move around the world and work on contracts from 3 months to 6 months to 1 year, from place to place to place. You might get lucky and just get a job straight after, but most people don't. So, you know, be prepared to live all over the world. And if that doesn't work for you with family commitments or anything else, then maybe that's not something you should, you know, set your heart on with and have no alternatives. But I think if you go into it thinking like, look, this is something I'd love to do, I'll give it a go and see where it goes. But kind of keep your options open and think about other stuff. I also think when I started the PhD, I didn't fully appreciate how slow everything is. That, like, you know, if you think through it logically and you're like, right, well, I'm doing a 4-year PhD and at the end of the PhD, I want to get a job. And if I want to get a job, I have to have several publications because everybody applying for the job is going to have a PhD and they're going to have spoken at conferences and they're going to have all the same experience as you. So you need to have a couple of published papers. So if you're going to have published papers when you're applying for the job after your fourth year, they need to be written and they need to be going out to journals. But like some of the journals, it's like 2-year turnaround from when you send something in to when it might actually get published. So really, like, in your second year of your PhD, when you're just finding your feet and you're just even really working out what this whole thing is about, you need to be sending articles off to journals. And I just didn't fully appreciate how early I needed to be doing this until it was sort of way too late. So I think you need to work backwards. You need to be like, right, these are my goals. This is what I want to do. I want to be a lecturer, or I want to develop other skills alongside this because I want to keep this field open or whatever. And I think you need to really sort of look at the end and work your way backwards from there and start developing those skills on the side, or start getting your things published or whatever really, really early, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you need to be quite sort of ruthless about it, which is not easy to do because you're also trying to do a PhD. But, you know, I think that sort of planning for your career from the day you start the PhD is probably something you want to think about, which I just didn't appreciate early enough at all. So maybe that would be my advice.
Do you think there's anything else I should ask you? Anything of interest that you think, God, we should highlight this?
One of the questions you had was about like your sort of identity as a researcher, yeah. Which I thought was kind of interesting, because I think in a way for me, having, you know, I've kept the words to that effect, the podcast going, you know, throughout. And for me, that's kind of like my little toehold in academia. So I can do other stuff and I can be doing podcasting and do various things like that. But I feel like I've never left the sort of research world fully behind, which I really like, because I put out these episodes and I do a lot of research for each one. And that little bit of research, crucially on something that interests me, I'm not looking for research grants or whatever else, but just being able to having that little push to kind of keep up with my field and do a little bit of research without it being overwhelming or anything else has been really nice. I think that kind of that's sort of my identity as a researcher, or as somebody who, you know, works in English literature or something, I've managed to kind of keep that connection a little bit through the podcast, which is something I really like.
I think it's quite interesting that you say that, because just yesterday I read an article about, you know, people who maybe were more heavily involved in research in the sense that they had a research position for years, or they were working as a postdoc maybe for 2 years, 1 year, 2 years, consecutively over 8-10 years, and the identity loss or the change in identity that they experienced and had to rebuild when they moved into another role was immense.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you say that you're still kind of, you know, protective of that piece, and you still nurture that, and that's quite important.
Yeah, and I can't really see, even if down the line I decide, look, I'll end that podcast, I feel like I'll almost certainly start another project of some type that involves research in English literature in some shape or form, because I just don't really see myself ever leaving that behind fully. Partly because it's like, I put all this work into it, I want to use it for something. But also just because I love it. Like, that's why I did all of this in the first place, because I really enjoy it. And I don't want to just completely leave that behind.
Connor, it's been absolutely lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. We've come to the end of this episode of our podcast, Exploring Research Careers. If you like the podcast, maybe you want to tell your friends and colleagues, or anyone who you think might get benefit from listening to the conversations. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @Eeyore_careers, where you can find new episodes as they're released. In the meantime, thanks for listening and take care.